afterwards. I went to Paris, and there I met his lawyer, Frankel, Dr. Frankel.
May I, Mr. Greenspan, I do not wish to overburden the court with too much detail. My question was, did you succeed in finding any indication, any clue?
Nothing. Nothing. I kept on looking. To this day, to this day. To this day, I have found nothing.
Within the Jewish world, Greenspan is a much remembered figure. Someone who's remembered ambivalently. Someone who struck back, but who as a result had triggered a ghastly series of events that claimed the lives of thousands of Jewish people.
Germans focus so much rhetorical energy on using Greenspan as an argument for the existence of a world Jewish conspiracy that Jews quite naturally took up the opposing position that this had nothing to do with any Jewish organization or any Jewish sentiment or whatever, so that Greenspan was viewed as kind of a freak event. And the less said about the Greenspan case, the better. And in a way, that disposition stuck. It stuck even until after the war. So this certainly interesting and certainly fateful event and series of events didn't get the historical attention and perhaps even recognition that it should have. And I wonder if Mr. Tippett's oratorio isn't in some way a bit of a down payment on that.
That was Herschel Greenspan, the Forgotten Assassin. The contributors were Ron Royson, Gerald Schwab, John Najem, and David Cesarani. Several readings were taken from Kristallnacht, Unleashing the Holocaust, by Anthony Reed and David Fisher. And the readers were Susie Riddell, Patrick Brennan, and Joe Sims. The producer was Emma Harding. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Catherine Bott, for the second half of tonight's Prom, live on BBC Radio 3. There's just one work, Sir Michael Tippett's oratorio, A Child of Our Time, which had as its catalyst the events we heard about in the interval feature. The members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra are just starting to gather on stage, and they'll shortly be joined by a quartet of American and British solo singers, and already on the stage is a large chorus. Oh, I forgot to mention the conductor, but you knew David Robertson was going to be here. This large chorus is not just any chorus. I'm very excited to introduce them to you. You're about to hear the debut of the 300 voices of the Proms Youth Choir, assembled especially for tonight, but destined to appear at the Proms for the next 4 years. The singers are aged between 14 and 24, and they come from 5 choirs selected from across the UK, as follows. The CBSO Youth Chorus from Birmingham, Key Voices from The Sage in Gateshead, the National Youth Choir of Scotland, Codetta from Derry in Northern Ireland, and the Glenethley Senior Choir from Wales. They were all prepared in advance by their own choir masters. They came together on Sunday with director Simon Halsey for 2 intensive days of rehearsals, and then joined the BBC Symphony Orchestra yesterday for rehearsals in Reading, so they're very well travelled. During this afternoon's rehearsal, 2 of the young singers told me about the experience of singing at the Proms. Yeon Jones from Glenethwy Senior Choir, and first Laura Sheeran, who sings with Codetta in Derry. And she told me about how all the choirs had been getting to know each other.
We had a little game in our choir of you have to meet at least 2 new people every day, or you have to sit in a new section of your section to try and get a more cohesive bond for the project.
So you could back up my view that singing is not only good for your heart and your lungs, it's also good for your social life.
Oh, absolutely. You meet lots of lovely people and from all over the UK, so it's a wonderful opportunity for everyone.
What about singing with an orchestra? Because when choirs rehearse at home, they tend to have a piano and not the full band.
I think it brings everything together, because you rehearse the song at home and you rehearse it with the rest of the choir. When you come into the hall and hear the orchestra play the accompaniment, it's just a fantastic noise.
And it's not just any orchestra.
No. Laura Sheeran and Yeon Jones, 2 members of the Proms Youth Choir, talking to me during a rehearsal break. They're so enlivening and heartening to see around the Albert Hall, but I have to say, now in their concert black, they are all sitting like experienced professionals, silent and still, at the back of the stage. Michael Tippett was always keenly aware of social injustice and oppression of all kinds, and came to feel that he must express his solidarity with the deprived and downtrodden through his music. The catalyst for A Child of Our Time was the shooting of a German diplomat by a young Polish Jew, Herschel Greenspan, and the dreadful Kristallnacht that followed. Tippett asked the poet T.S. Eliot if he would write the libretto for a work that would be a public declaration of horror at Nazi oppression. Eliot cautiously agreed, but when he saw Tippett's initial scenario, he suggested that the composer should write his own text, an idea that Tippett followed for the rest of his career. The structure of the piece is based on Handel's Messiah, so it's in three parts. In Tippett's own words, Part 1 deals with the general state of oppression in our time. Part 2 presents the particular story of a young man's attempt to seek justice through violence and the catastrophic consequences. And Part 3 considers the moral to be drawn, if any. The oratorio, composed between 1939 and 41, was written when no one could foresee the outcome of the Second World War, but tonight's conductor, David Robertson, definitely believes Tippett's vision was prescient. Well, joining the BBC Symphony Orchestra and the Proms Youth Choir here in a moment will be the soloists, the ladies both British, the gentlemen American, soprano Sally Matthews, mezzo-soprano Sarah Connolly, tenor Paul Groves and bass baritone Jubilant Sykes, with conductor David Robertson for this Proms performance of Michael Tippett's A Child of Our Time.
Thank you. Oh, continual persecution. One race stood for all. Fled from the terror. And among them a boy escaped secretly and was kept in hiding from a great city.
Land.
Let us all keep on.
words of wisdom are these. Winter court means in a wharf, a secret nursery of the sea. Is born in the tension of loneliness. The garden lies beyond the desert.
Outcast is
What a powerful and heartfelt plea ending Michael Tippett's oratorio, A Child of Our Time, performed tonight to a rapt audience here in the Royal Albert Hall. The soloists were soprano Sally Matthews, mezzo-soprano Sarah Connolly, tenor Paul Groves, and bass baritone Jubilant Sykes, with the BBC Symphony Orchestra leader Stephen Bryant, and making a wonderful debut, the fresh voices of the BBC Proms Youth Choir, director Simon Halsey. They sang with skill, commitment, and at the end, from memory, on their first Proms outing. The good news is, they'll be back at the Proms next year. At the end of the rehearsal today, Simon Halsey called for a huge round of applause for all five of their individual choral conductors, so I'm going to make sure they get on-air credit now. The CBSO Youth Chorus from Birmingham is conducted by Julian Wilkins. The key voices from The Sage in Gateshead by Matthew Beckingham. The National Youth Choir of Scotland by Christopher Bell. Codetta from Derry in Northern Ireland. Donald Doherty is the man. And Glanethwy Senior Choir from Wales is directed by Kevin Roberts. The performance was conducted by David Robertson, and let's give him the last word on A Child of Our Time. It is, he says, one of the finest moments of illumination in one of the darkest periods of history. And on that note, with Simon Halsey taking the stage to applause from all his choirs, it's time for me, Catherine Bott, to hand you back for the rest of your Radio 3 evening to Ian Skelly in Broadcasting House.
Catherine, thank you very much. Catherine Bott at the Royal Albert Hall for tonight's ecstatic prom. We're back there tomorrow night for an evening of Bach, a performance of Bach's B minor mass, in fact, a monumental work written towards the end of his life, comprising of plenty of music he'd written in the past for various religious occasions. Harry Bickett conducts the soloists, English concert and choir, and the concert will be introduced by Donald MacLeod tomorrow night, who's also to be heard presenting Composer of the Week, as always this week, and the series this week is exploring plenty of Bach's other late music. Tomorrow, just before the prom, you can hear the results of Bach's trip to Potsdam, just 3 years before his death, when he visited Frederick the Great, who effectively challenged Bach to compose a piece for him on the spot, which Bach then did, and when he got home, augmented, too, the piece that became his celebrated musical offering. Composer of the Week tells the story at 6:30 tomorrow evening, and then our visit to the prom tomorrow night is at 7:30, all here on BBC Radio 3. Well, we're going to hear the English concert in action in the next 50 minutes or so, so do stay tuned. Not playing Bach, though, but music by one of his exact contemporaries. Let's hear Bach first, though. This is another liturgical piece which drew heavily on other music Bach had written. It's the Sinfonia, the opening number to his Easter oratorio, parts of which actually began life as a secular cantata, written to celebrate the birthday of the Duke of Saxony-Weissenfels at the time. So perhaps that explains this rather stately opening. I can just see the Duke now riding through the countryside on a heavily caparisoned horse. Thank you. The Sinfonia that opens Bach's Easter Oratorio, BWV 249, played there by the Orchestra of Collegium Vocale, conducted by Philippe Herrewecher. And as I say, plenty more choral music by Bach tomorrow night when we have a complete performance of his B minor mass live here on BBC Radio 3 from 7:30. Here's a rather marvellous piece of Bach. This is one of his preludes and fugues, originally for organ, but this is a transcription by Liszt, who captures here a very haunting flavour that underpins the music. Hélène Grameau is the pianist. Hélène Grammeau playing the Prelude and Fugue in A minor by Bach, originally BWV 543, a prelude and fugue for organ, but that was the piano version. Having passed through the imagination of Liszt, a very telltale flourish to finish there from Liszt. Well, it's an all Bach prom tomorrow night, and on stage will be the English Concert. Here they are, now, playing music by an exact contemporary of Bach, George Frederick Handel, a very different personality to Bach, who took a very different and much more sparkling course from his rather more comfortable beginnings in Germany, too. Towards the end of Handel's life, he turned out one of his most enduring compositions, all to celebrate a peace treaty in 1748. The king ordered a concert to celebrate the fact in Green Park in London, and he wanted warlike instruments to play it. But Handel had other ideas and softened the impression by insisting on the addition of strings. After all, not only would there be music, there'd also be fireworks, plus the fact it was said to be a very large orchestra on the night. Well, here's a lesser number, but in the form of tomorrow night's proms performers, the English Concert under Trevor Pinnock on this occasion, making, I would say, a more than sufficient noise to accompany all those flashes and bangs in the sky.
Thank you.
excerpts from the music for the Royal Fireworks by Handel, played there by the English Concert, directed by Trevor Pinnock. And the English Concert will be there on stage at the Proms tomorrow night as part of a full performance of Bach's B minor Mass. Harry Bickett will conduct tomorrow night, and you can hear that performance at 7:30, live on the home of the BBC Proms, BBC Radio 3. Where now, Richard Coles presents the second programme in the series, first broadcast last year, Out in the World, A Global Gay History. In tonight's programme, featuring some explicit descriptions, Richard turns his attention to the impact of Judaism, Christianity and Islam. But he begins on a journey to uncover the very different culture and attitudes of ancient Greece.
Well, we're sitting in a cab, a Greek cab, driving out from Athens, past Thebes, into the glory that was Greece, and some of the great names from classical antiquity, Mount Parnassus, Mount Helicon. Today, surrounded by the rather prosaic stuff of infrastructure, we have power cables, roads, and then up on the mountains themselves, wind turbines turning rather listlessly. But nothing listless about us as we head to Chaeronea, scene of two famous battles in antiquity, and one of them key to our story, in trying to understand something about how the ancient Greeks understood the homoerotic bond, because it was there that the army of lovers, the Theban band, feared throughout the classical world, met their Waterloo, if I may call it that, at the hands of Alexander the Great and his father Philip of Macedon.
Perish any man who suspects that these men either did or suffered anything that was base.
That, according to the historian Plutarch, was how Philip of Macedon assessed the moral qualities of the sacred band. It was not without precedent. Plato himself, in Symposium, had argued that a fighting unit made up exclusively of male lovers would be both feared and revered.
Who would desert his beloved or fail him in the hour of danger? The veriest coward would become an inspired hero, equal to the bravest at such a time. Love would inspire him.
Does it surprise us that the virtues of virility and gallantry should be attributed to a band of same-sex warrior lovers in ancient Greece? That's one of the questions we'll explore in this second programme in our series looking at global gay history. And if it is a surprise, how much is that down to the rise of the Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Christianity and Islam, with their shared prohibition of same-sex activity?
Thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind. It is an abomination.
Pretty unambiguous stuff, or so it seems, and a view that's prevailed across much of the world and for hundreds of years. Striking then that the ancient Greeks, who were to give so much to the Judeo-Christian tradition, should in this have differed so markedly.
From the Roman period onwards, the Greek custom had been very important, what the Romans called the Greek custom, and what more recent commentators call Greek love.
Professor James Davidson, author of The Greeks and Greek Love, aims to disentangle the complicated ways the rest of us have tried to understand or to condemn sexual practices in ancient Greece. And these have been complicated since at least Roman times.
Because it was so noisily celebrated, not just in Greek literature, but also in Greek art, and because it was in such important authors as Plato, who were widely read, it was never something that was forgotten. But different interpretations were possible. You could have a very innocent interpretation where it was all about Platonic love, and others thought about it as a terrible, unchristian vice.
The whole picture of our study of ancient Greece was transformed, really, in the late 70s by Kenneth Dover, Sir Kenneth Dover. He was actually a stunningly brilliant academic scholar in every respect.
Paul Cartledge, Professor of Greek Culture at Cambridge University, argues that the contribution of Kenneth Dover is profoundly important here.
He started off lexically in terms of what words the Greeks used to describe various aspects of male-male sexual relations. And though he called his book Greek Homosexuality, which of course is a modern term, it's a bastard, it's a combination of Latin and Greek, though he called it Greek homosexuality, what he actually was talking about was what the Greeks called paiderastia. And I'm not sure quite why he used the title homosexuality, because it was inappropriate. But at any rate, he distinguished very sharply between the older partner, who was the active partner, and the Greek word has an active sense. Erastes means somebody who actively desires. And the beloved is in the Greek in the passive voice, so he has something done to him. And in this case, he has arrows directed towards him. And arrows for the Greeks is not just boring old love, but actually passion. Erotics is a very strong term in ancient Greek. That really is where we're coming from. When we study now today ancient Greek homosexuality, we are looking at it through spectacles to some degree planted on our noses by Kenneth Dover in the late 70s.
James Davidson, peering through those spectacles, argues that paiderastia, pederasty, is a system or code that has itself been oversimplified.
There is a popular impression that Greek homosexuality is about dirty old men and young boys. That isn't the impression you get from the sources. It's much more likely to be between someone in their 20s and someone who's 18 or 19, or if it's a case of admiring someone who's 18, 19, and someone who's 15 or 16.
And paiderastia is just one way men related to other men. City-states, island kingdoms, all had their own way of doing things.
There are three different kinds of relationship, if you like. There are these following relationships of admirers from a distance. Then there are one-to-one relationships, which might actually involve pledges, even something which is associated with marriage. And then, of course, there's also sexual relations. So when authors talk about Greek love, they're referring to all three of those kinds of relationship. In Athens, the emphasis was on seduction and stalking, if you like, these gangs of admirers who would follow someone around, sleep in doorways, write their name, write poetry. We see a nice example of that in Plato's Charmides, where the eponymous beauty Charmides, who in fact turns out to be a nasty right-wing politician, but here he is in his youth and he's followed around by gangs of people.
When I saw him coming in, I confess that I was quite astonished at his beauty and stature. All the world seemed to be enamoured of him. Amazement and confusion reigned when he entered, and a troop of lovers followed him. That grown-up men like ourselves should have been affected in this way was not surprising, but I observed that there was the same feeling among the boys. All of them, down to the very least child, turned and looked at him as if he had been a statue.
Other cities, the practices were considered so horrendous. This is, I'm thinking of Elis in particular, in the city of the Olympic Games, which caused other Greeks to worry about it. There was something was wrong with it. It broke too many taboos, I think. Finally, in Thebes, their peculiar characteristic was considered to be formal marriages between people who were close in age and also people who were fighting together. The most famous example of that is the Sacred Band. And other Greeks thought that was very odd, that you had people who were in erotic relationships, in amorous relationships, who were also part of the same contingent of the army.
The Sacred Band of Thebes met its end at Chaeronea in 338 BCE. There I was bound, on the road out of Athens, with John Camp, director of the Agora excavations.
Off to the right, the valley is opening up, which is essentially the superhighway leading into Greece that takes you north and then east of Mount Parnassus. Everywhere else, you have big high mountains, but there's this big broad valley about 3 miles across, which leads you right into southern Greece. And it's not surprising the battle took place at Chaeronea. It's a natural place to try to stop an invading enemy.
That's Parnassus.
Parnassus, well, dead ahead.
That's where you want to keep
the Acropolis of Chaeronea, just to the left, coming up now, the rocky one. And the lion will be another kilometer or so on our left.
About an hour and a half, 2 hours out of Athens, practically in the shade of Mount Parnassus, we've come across this extraordinary monument. It's just by the side of the road.
40 feet high. There's a stone plinth, and on top of it, there's this lion that's sitting back on its haunches, muscular, maned, looking out across the battlefield of Chaeronea. Is it right to call this a monument, John?
It is. It's certainly a funerary monument because years ago excavations were carried out down below and 254 skeletons were found within the enclosure around the lion. So it's presumably a funerary marker for a group of fallen warriors.
And it wouldn't be too much to speculate that those fallen warriors were in fact the Theban band.
That is what most people believe. You had 300 men in that band, and there's a group of 254 buried here, and we're told that the band was pretty much annihilated by the Macedonian army, so the numbers seem to work pretty well.
And why should a massacre of just a couple of hundred, 300 men earn such a magnificent monument as this?
Well, those men were regarded as the absolute elite of the Theban army. They were, in effect, the garrison of the city. They were professional soldiers at a time when most of the soldiers were citizen fighters, and they were known for their bravery for the generation or two when they were active.
I suppose one of the things that's most widely discussed with the Theban band is that they were sometimes described as an army of lovers, that they were paired and intimately involved with each other. Is that right?
That's what the ancient sources tell us. Plutarch describes them as 150 pairs of lovers. And philosophically, you can go back to Plato's Symposium to find that the concept that a pair of lovers will fight especially hard.
The lover who is detected in doing any dishonorable act or submitting through cowardice when any dishonor is done to him by another will be more pained at being detected by his beloved than at being seen by his father or by his companions or by anyone else.
Alongside the lion, there's the inevitable museum, John, and this one looks like it's been rather well refurbished.
Yes, it's the regional museum. It has material from all over this part of Greece, and the lion out there marks a grave, and we have here some of the material from that grave.
So this is Theban material?
This is Theban material.
What we're looking at, there's some ceramics. There's a couple of dishes with a handle and then bowls with twin handles. There's some what look like beads of some kind. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, here obviously some arrowheads, but then also this rather interesting, it looks like a sort of long, narrow, curved spoon with a handle.
That's right. Those are strigils. And they're used by young men in the gymnasium to scrape off the sand and the sweat and the dust and the oil after they had exercised. So they're something that you would find in a young man's kit, the young people who attended the gymnasium on a fairly regular basis. They're not something you'd necessarily carry into battle, so these may have been brought out by their families to inter with the dead.
So would these have been the strigils that belonged to the Theban band, perhaps?
Presumably so.
Yeah, interesting.
Or at least family gifts.
And part of their culture was gymnasium culture. They would go there to prepare themselves, body and soul and spirit, for the duties that were laid on their shoulders, which were significant.
Absolutely. The gymnasium is essential to Greek culture. And the fact that they did that in the nude is one of the identifying features of the ancient Greeks.
Of such stuff, a great deal of material in our time, which speculates about the eroticism of those cultures, revolves around the gymnasium too, doesn't it?
Very much so.
For a society to make so much fuss about the male body, to produce all that idealism, all that nudity, and then also to have these extraordinary love poems, which are about, well, not just men, of course. There's also Sappho, who's one of the greatest female poets from antiquity. Where else can you talk about the sex lives of people who lived 2,500 years ago?
Professor James Davidson. And if there is a love even more silent than that which dare not speak its name, it's surely the love between women. The status of women in ancient Greek society, just about everywhere in early European history, meant that there's much less on female than male homosexuality in the historical record. Sappho, for example, famously not as other women, is really known only through her poems. Professor Margaret Reynolds.
If we think specifically about the poems of Sappho, one of the most famous of these is a poem that is generally called Fragment 1. It's an ode to Aphrodite, goddess of love. And in it, the speaker, who is Sappho herself, because at one point the goddess addresses her and says, "Who has now wronged you, Sappho?" So her name is actually included in the poem. And she's asking Aphrodite to help her to be reunited with some lover who has left her and that she wants to get back together again with. And the lover is definitely female, because Aphrodite says, even if she is unwilling, and in the Greek, the word unwilling is definitely feminine. So this is a poem by a woman speaker addressed to a woman speaker. The other key poem that makes Sappho into a lesbian, perhaps, is Fragment 31. It begins, "That man seems to me more than the gods." And it is a speaker looking at a man who is sitting beside a girl, and the speaker is clearly in love with the girl.
"It seems to me that man is equal to the gods. That is, whoever sits opposite you and drawing nearer savours as you speak the sweetness of your voice and the thrill of your laugh, which have so stirred the heart in my own breast that whenever I catch sight of you, even if for a moment, then my voice deserts me and my tongue is struck silent. A delicate fire suddenly races underneath my skin. My eyes see nothing. My ears whistle like the whirling of a top. And sweat pours down me. And a trembling creeps over my whole body. I am greener than grass."
How do we know that the speaker is also a woman? Because at one point the speaker says, "I am greener than grass," chlorotera in the Greek. And the chlorotera is feminine. We don't know what greener than grass means, whether she's, you know, sick with desire or young and innocent or afraid. We don't know. But the point is it's feminine, it's chlorotera. So here is a poem spoken by a woman speaker addressed to a beloved who is female.
"At such times, I seem to be no more than a step away from death."
I think that it's almost impossible for us now, from our point of view, with all the layers of prohibition that surround same-sex relationships, to think ourselves back into the kind of situation that existed for the ancient Greeks. I think that things were so much more open, so much more slippery, so much more unfixed. The fact that you loved, and you might do, a young boy that you're educating in the ways of the world, or in a woman's case, a young woman, was quite separate from the love that you bore to your mother, to your daughter, to your husband. And you could have all these loves side by side. Somebody like Sappho, she's saying to an adolescent girl, this is what it's like to feel desire. This is what might happen to you. In a very frank way, which actually we could all do with now, because it would be hugely helpful for young women in particular, but boys too, approaching adolescence, to know what weird and wonderful things their bodies might start saying to them, which they can't even understand. And I think the Greeks had a framework for allowing those possibilities not to impinge upon or threaten the more grown-up, responsible relationships to your children, to your parents, to your spouses, that had to be held onto at the same time.
"And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, I am the Lord your God. After the doings of the land of Egypt, wherein ye dwelt, shall ye not do. But after the doings of the land of Canaan, whither I bring you, shall ye not do. Neither shall ye walk in their ordinances. Ye shall do my judgments, and keep mine ordinances, to walk therein."
Regime change. But actually, the triumph of monotheistic religion was not one of decisive conquest, but a gradual and layered process which encountered other cultures and their values in a variety of ways. In the Roman Empire, while homoerotic sex was not especially unusual, it wasn't part of the civic structure as it had been in Athens and Thebes. We know of the Emperor Hadrian's love for Antinous by the many monuments he erected to him after his untimely death by drowning. But as Christianity, with its Jewish heritage, gathered momentum, it brought with it those powerfully prohibitive texts from, for example, the book of Leviticus. Thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind. It is abomination. It doesn't seem to allow for much latitude. But Rabbi Mark Solomon, lecturer in the Talmud at Leo Beck College in London, believes this text, written in about the 6th century BCE, around the time of the Babylonian exile, should be read in context.
Very prominent among the theories about why these laws are there in Leviticus is that this was a small desert people, nomadic people in the very early days. Although, of course, by the time Leviticus was really written, that was probably no longer so much the case, who needed to ensure their survival and procreation. A kind of sex that can never give rise to procreation was seen as abominable, as wrong.
It's so interesting how people really, they just like a magnet go to that passage in Leviticus.
Dr. Rebecca Alpert of Temple University, rabbi and scholar, is also uneasy about accepting Leviticus's apparent simplicity uncritically.
Nobody knows what the word abomination means in that Levitical passage. The Hebrew word is to'evah, which is the word that we can't translate. I mean, we really don't know what it means. It's probably a bad thing, but abomination is maybe a bit of an overstatement. So this word to'evah was used by the rabbis. They said, well, why should you not have homosexual relations? Because you will go astray because of it. And that's really a play on words with the word to'evah. The word go astray is to'eh atah bah. So they were playing with words, but the meaning was very clear. That is, the prohibition means, this might be very enticing to you, but we want you to have children, so don't do it.
I think that this very, very strict and serious prohibition of homosexual intercourse was yet another way of preserving and enforcing the rigid distinction that I think the Torah wants between men and women in a what I think was probably a deeply patriarchal society where power and most property were in the hands of men. In sexual relations, men are to relate to women in a particular way, the male as the penetrator, the female as the penetrated, and for a male to penetrate another male. And that's very much what the language of those verses seems to imply. A man shall not lie with a male as one lies with a woman. Seems to me to be saying, don't treat another man, sexually speaking, as a woman. There's something inherently horrific to the mind of these writers of Leviticus in the idea of a man being feminized, being reduced, as they probably would have seen it, to womanly status.
Again, the status of women means there's a dearth of material about female same-sex relations in early Judaic writing, although there is later commentary on the subject, according to Rebecca Alpert.
The question gets raised in the Talmud, which likes to ask very arcane questions. Well, can a woman who has had these sexual relationships with another woman, or these misolelet, they were called rubbing relationships with other women, are they still eligible to marry a priest? It meant, are they still a virgin? That's the first time lesbianism gets mentioned in any way, is can a woman who has had sexual relationships with another woman still be considered a virgin for the purposes of her marriage to a man? And the answer was yes. Again, because penetration was the only criterion for sexuality. So that's the one mention that you find in the early rabbinic period, a little bit after the time of Jesus, of women having sexual relationships with each other in Jewish tradition. But it's very, very hard and probably a bad idea to try to imagine that you could take any of those ancient texts literally.
Nevertheless, those texts, Leviticus, for example, demands the death penalty for men who have sex with other men. Their blood is upon them. And the death penalty is still on the statutes of Muslim countries like Iran, Mauritania, Saudi Arabia, and Sudan to this day. Islam, which emerged in the 7th century alongside Judaism and Christianity, seems again to present a contradictory picture of both rigour and latitude in its attitude to lesbian and gay sex. The texts again seem straightforward. This is the Quranic version of the story of Lot in an English translation by Muhammad Asad.
Remember Lot when he said unto his people, "Will you commit abominations such as none in all the world has ever done before you? Verily, with lust you approach men instead of women. Nay, but you are people given to excesses." But his people's only answer was this, "Expel them from your land. Verily, they are folk who make themselves out to be pure." Thereupon we saved him and his household, except his wife, who was among those that stayed behind, the while we rained a rain of destruction upon the others. And behold, what happened in the end to those people lost in sin?
Homosexuality is discussed in the main text of Muslims, and that is the Quran. And also it is elaborated in the prophetic tradition. But it comes under the general concern of Islam with sexuality in general.
Professor Madawi al-Rashid of King's College, London University.
The first mention of homosexuality is Lot, who is an apostle, who tells about the people of Sodom. And those people of Sodom have actually had excesses in all aspects of their life. And one such excess is having sex with men. Yet those sodomites, if you like, are bisexual rather than homosexual. So they have wives, they enjoy sex with their wives, but also they have transgressed in the sense that they have sought pleasures elsewhere that are forbidden. And therefore they are warned. Lot warns them and gives them the opportunity to repent.
Some scholars in the Judeo-Christian tradition have suggested there's an ambiguity about that passage, and that the crime is one against hospitality, and it's not clear from the Hebrew quite what that means. Is that an ambiguity that is transmitted into Islamic understanding of the text, or is that much clearer?
It's very clear. Remember, the Book of Muslims is in Arabic, and this Arabic has multiple meanings. But there is a consensus that the people of Sodom were actually practicing pleasures with men without actually using the word homosexuality. It doesn't actually exist as a word in the Quran, but there are references to pleasures with men.
Transgressive sexual pleasures.
Yes, yeah. Obviously. They are condemned, but they are given the opportunity to repent, and therefore they can be forgiven, but they don't, and therefore God punishes them. So this is the level of text that everybody knows, everybody cites.
So as in Judaism and Christianity, the foundational texts seem to offer clarity and rigour, but cultures take up texts in ways that are often ambiguous.
I chatted with my darling, all reserve cast aside, then subdued this reluctant boy, not given to excess. He burst into song, my right arm pillowing his cheek. How often have I sought what cannot be attained? So I shot my love between that kind boy's twin loins, and him my best friend and honoured guest. I woke at dawn cursing drunkenness, though it had been generous to me.
Abu Nuwas is a very famous Arab poet who celebrates his love for young men. But also we find Muslim caliphs in Damascus and Baghdad in the medieval period enjoying the pleasures of the flesh with other men.
And those are presented as people deriving erotic pleasure, not simply as a kind of expression of power and prestige. This is actually about physical pleasure.
It's about seeking pleasures. But at the same time, to seek pleasure in that kind of way is celebrated in poetry, but the person doesn't become a homosexual, in inverted commas. And he may have a wife, he may have children, but at the same time, he enjoys the company.